From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, opening top schools to low-income students, recruiting and retaining them.
We've gone back to our roots, making sure that we include among our student body students from a variety of ethnic and economic backgrounds.
This is a nut we have to crack if we're serious about equal opportunity in the United States.
Why GM can't put the ignition switch scandal in its rearview mirror?
All of the car companies are going to be ultimately impacted by what General Motors did or did not do here.
And a late-season roller coaster ride for Tigers fans.
Each time you think this team is about to get it right, they do what they did last night to the last-place team in the division, and they gave it away.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Elite colleges promise to do it, admit more low-income students. Yet most top-tier schools in America have not increased their number of poor students in a generation. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, economic diversity in college enrollment. And then, 5 days left, it's a new novel getting strong reviews. But first, when General Motors appointed Kenneth Feinberg as its so-called compensation czar, it was pretty clear the automaker hoped to have Feinberg determine damages to victims of the ignition switch debacle, pay up, and move on. But as Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes writes today, things are not quite working out that way. Daniel, all through those excruciating congressional hearings, GM maintained that 13 people died because of the ignition switch problem. This week, Kenneth Feinberg bumped that up to 19.
That's right. He did. And every Monday, people are going to come back and be updating the public and or the media on where those numbers stand. He bumped to 50%, and we don't know where that's ultimately going to end up. He confirmed that he had 131 death claims. Now, making a claim and having him actually agree that it's a claim are two different things. It's important to note here that the 13 deaths that General Motors confirmed to Congress were deaths that they believed were attributable to an airbag that did not deploy because of a defective ignition switch. Now, as GM people have pointed out to me, Feinberg's definition is much more elastic and less specific.
Mm.
So it's not necessarily an apples-to-apples comparison. Having said that, most people who don't work in the auto industry don't really and aren't going to pay a lot of attention to those fine distinctions. What they're going to be looking at, if they look at it at all, is what are the death numbers.
And what do you think this growing death count means for General Motors beyond the sheer dollars and cents of the damages to be paid?
Well, I think it's hard to tell. I mean, I think one of the points I made today is that we don't really know what the cost of this is going to be. If these numbers get a lot larger on the death count, 13 becomes a factor of X times X, I think that may hurt General Motors' credibility and trust factor in the marketplace, their ability to rebuild confidence with existing customers, particularly people who own those cars or own them, and would-be customers. I mean, GM is at a point right now where it's building some of the best cars and trucks in its history, and yet they've got brands like Cadillac that are struggling and are not definitely not doing as well as they're expected to do.
You also pointed to a speech this week by Attorney General Eric Holder that you felt is pretty significant to General Motors.
Yeah, he spoke in Washington yesterday and basically put corporate America on notice that said, you know, fining companies for bad behavior is not enough. That at the end of the day, companies don't make mistakes and bad investments or put bad products in the marketplace. People make those decisions. And he basically said we need to start going after executives. He didn't mention General Motors by name, but I don't know that he necessarily had to. Clearly, this administration, through the Justice Department, is becoming a lot more aggressive in investigating and going after what they perceive to be corporate wrongdoing.
We should also note this has been an absolutely horrible week for the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration with that House committee report that just tore NHTSA apart and then a Senate panel that did the same. So there's not a whole lot to defend if you're the agency that's supposedly the safety watchdog for the drivers of America.
Well, that's right. I think there's a real feeling that NHTSA tends to be a little too cozy with the car companies. And they're very defensive here. I think, you know, typically to hit a cynical note, I think, you know, the government never wants to admit that it's wrong or that it hasn't actually done things the right way. I think General Motors has acknowledged that it was clearly wrong, and you don't have much of a choice because I think it's pretty obvious. But I think NHTSA is going to get more pressure from Congress. There's going to be some legislation that's going to be handed down, I think, as part of a traffic and a highway bill that's going to push them to be a little bit more aggressive. The sum total here is that all of the car companies are going to be ultimately impacted by what General Motors did or did not do here. And you've already seen companies starting to beef up their compliance and safety organizations and change the ways in which recalls and other things are reported up the chain to senior management. All of that, I think, can be directly attributed to General Motors and the ignition switch recall.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. As always, thank you so much, Daniel.
Thank you.
Michigan's Senator Carl Levin is retiring this year, and that has some top business leaders breathing a big sigh of relief. Michigan's senior senator has been running a very tight ship in chairing a Senate subcommittee that's done some pretty deep probing into the workings of big business. Kelsey Snell's piece for Politico really says it all. Corporate world exhales with Levin exit. Good to have you with us, Kelsey.
Thanks so much for having me.
What is the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, the PSI? What does it do?
The Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations was created back when Harry S. Truman was in the Senate, and it was set up to investigate war profiteering. It has evolved over time, and it's kind of a chairman-driven committee where the person in charge gets to look anywhere they want in government or in business and issue subpoenas and do long probing investigations. It just has so happens that Carl Levin found big business and tax evasion and Wall Street to be his big driving force.
Now, the PSI doesn't have power to write legislation. So why is it, as you write, that Senator Carl Levin, I love the quote, widely feared on Wall Street and in boardrooms across the country?
Well, he, unlike most other chairmen in the Senate, has the ability to issue subpoenas. So any person that he feels like looking into actually is compelled to respond. That gives him a kind of unique power where he can bring some of the biggest names, like we saw that executives from HP, Microsoft, and Apple had to come and testify and face actual direct questioning. It's a pretty scary place to be, and it's very well publicized, it's well videotaped, and it's well circulated.
Give us a bigger idea. What kinds of things has Senator Levin and the PSI gone after and uncovered?
Well, his big love is going after what he sees as unfairness and where he thinks that the little guy is maybe getting a bad deal. So he really focused on Wall Street, tax evasion, and places where the companies were making choices that were probably legal within the bounds of the laws it was written to avoid doing what he saw as their duty as taxpayers. So when you saw him bring in Apple CEO, it was a conversation about whether or not their perfectly legal tax doing should be allowed to continue. Should Congress step in and change those rules? So it's a very complicated way that he gets at some very big problems.
And even though the committee or the PSI itself, this subcommittee, doesn't write legislation, it can certainly influence legislation that Congress writes.
Sure. Lots of times Congress doesn't take action unless there's a big political climate to make it comfortable so that they aren't scared that there will be backlash later. Having a big hearing that shines a light on some kind of corporate injustice really opens up the space for lawmakers to say to the public, there's a real problem here and we're going to fix it. And Levin's investigations were very good at shining that light.
Kelsey, who's being talked about as a possible replacement as PSI chair?
Well, it becomes a bit complicated because we are looking at a situation where the Senate could turn over and could no longer be in Democratic hands. If it stays with the Democrats, it's fairly clear that Claire McCaskill will probably, the senator from Missouri, will probably take over for Senator Levin. They have a very close relationship and have worked together on many issues outside of just these investigations. And he's been kind of personally keeping an eye on her and would like to see her replace him. If Republicans take over the Senate, there are seniority issues there. The most likely person to take over could be Senator Rand Paul, though after some investigation, I've actually heard people floating a whole list of other names, including Senator Rob Portman from Ohio, or even potentially having Senator John McCain stick around on the subcommittee, though that's highly unlikely.
So how might that change the types of investigations and, let's say, the ferocity of the investigations, contrasting it with the way that Senator Carl Levin's been doing it?
Sure. I mean, he had a particularly studious style. He treated it like he was almost a prosecutor in court. And he was really fascinated by these specific issues. The next person is not likely to share that exact same prosecutorial background. And Senator McCaskill has said that if she does take over the committee, she won't be quite as interested in the tax fairness issues and Wall Street. She's more interested in government contracting. And it's completely up to whoever takes over to kind of drive the direction and let their interests influence where the investigations go.
But it does rather seem that America's losing a senatorial pit bull as Carl Levin retires.
Absolutely. I have spoke with many, many, many people who said that Carl Levin has brought a lot of prestige and a really strong sense that PSI is an important, worthwhile subcommittee to the Senate, and he has been a very strong steward of that position.
Kelsey Snell, her piece for Politico is Corporate World Exhales with Levin Exit. Kelsey, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. These waning weeks of the regular baseball season are turning into quite the roller coaster ride for the Detroit Tigers and for their fans. Michigan Radio sports commentator John U. Bacon is here with us. Well, the Tigers got clobbered by the Twins last night in Kansas City 1, so that AL Central lead is down to just a half game over the Royals. And now the Tigers head to Kansas City for 3 games with the Royals. It could be really the most important series of the season. But John, someone here noted, you lose to the last place team in your division. Do you even deserve to go to the playoffs?
Based on that, no. And yet everyone else does too. So right now the American League Central, where the Tigers play with Kansas City and so on, is not a strong division. It seems to be who wants to lose at least is going to win this division.
Oh, boy. And then here Kansas City won, and now we've got this lead down to just a half a game over the Royals.
Going to be exciting, and that will almost certainly decide how this thing shakes out.
I tell you, we were at Comerica Park last Saturday night for that 5-4 win over Cleveland.
Tell us a story, Cindy. Tell us a story.
It was a great game. Lots to cheer about. So who showed up these past 2 nights against the Twins?
Well, in fairness to the Tigers, if you win 60% of your games, you have won in a landslide. It's like presidential politics. So in football, you expect to go 10-2 if you're any good. In baseball, if you win 60%, that is phenomenal. So you win and lose about half your games. But this team had a 7.5-game lead over the Royals in August, and now it's down to a nub. They're behind for a while, and they've since caught up. Each time you think this team is about to get it right, they do what they did last night to the last place team in the division, and they gave it away, basically.
Let's get your thoughts on the good, the bad, and the ugly. First of all, in batting.
Batting right now, the Tigers are looking great. They're leading the league in almost all offensive categories. You know, batting average, slugging percentage is second, I think. Batting average is first. The bats are great. So that's the good news.
But how worried are you when you watch Cabrera limping around the bases?
He is obviously banged up. He's not in good shape. But he's also usually playing a designated hitter, which keeps him out of the field, which means you got to swing the bat 3 to 4 times a game. And he's very good at that still. Even an injured Miguel Cabrera, who is probably the best hitter I've ever seen live in my lifetime. He won the Triple Crown 2 years ago, as you know. Mm-hmm. The first time since 1967. That's batting average, home runs, and RBI. And so he's still very good. That's not the problem. The problem is pitching. And pitching and pitching.
That's what I was going to get to now, as far as the good, the bad, and the ugly with the pitching.
That is both bad and ugly right now.
Not a lot good.
This is your problem.
And bullpen. Let's roll in the bullpen.
Oh, it used to be the starting pitching was great, with obviously Max Scherzer, of course, Justin Verlander. These are serious pitchers. And the relievers would come in and blow it for them. This is where Brad Ausmus, in his first year as manager, very smart guy, Dartmouth graduate, let's point out, and obviously a protege of Jim Leland, the old salty dog, has been doing this for eons. He tends to rely too much on what's called pitch count. Pitch count is simply how many pitches you throw in a night. And now they show this stat on TV as the guy is pitching. And as you approach 100 pitches, you tend to get pulled to save your arm. But if the pitcher is doing great through 8 innings and throwing a gem, 5 or 10 more pitches, who cares? And you bring in a reliever, you don't know what he's going to have that night. And then he turns around and blows it. So that has been a bit of a rookie move, in my opinion, on Brad Ausmus.
But Jim Leland got tagged for that, too. You know, somebody's having a great game, and you sent in Papa Grande.
Papa
Why?
Grande, exactly.
Yeah.
And Jim got this also.
Yeah.
One big difference, though, it seems to me, and Brad Ausmus is a very smart guy, very nice guy, well-liked. But if you look at Jim Leland's career, we talked about this before, almost all the players he had in Pittsburgh, in Florida, in Detroit, played their best baseball while playing for him. And it's hard to say exactly how a manager influences somebody's hitting or pitching or whatever.
Whatever the alchemy is.
Exactly. Who can say? But he had it. We know this, and we can prove this statistically. Ausmus right now does not seem to have this. Quite the opposite. He seems to have the reverse Midas touch.
David Price.
David Price, a hotshot pitcher out of Tampa Bay. They trade two very good players for him, of course. Drew Smyly, a young guy on his way up. They trade to Tampa. Drew Smyly is now pitching better than the veteran ace David Price is in Detroit. So this is not going well for Detroit.
So if the Tigers lose that first place, what do you think their chances are of a wild card?
Pretty good, actually. Right now, according to ESPN, they calculate all these things these days. Right now, the Tigers' chance of making it to the playoffs are 91%. That's this week. There are 10 games left. If you blow two or three games to the Royals, it goes way down very quickly. So that's where they stand right now. They have what's called a wild card in baseball. So you don't have to win your division. If you're one of the great runner-ups, then you still get in. And Tigers probably will. But with what kind of steam and confidence, it could be a short series, even in the playoffs.
I'll have to see if anybody has, any fans have any nails left after that.
If you're a Tigers fan, this has been a rough month, man.
Michigan Radio Sports Commentator John Eubank. And as always, thanks so much, John.
Thank you, Cindy.
What goes through the mind of someone who is just worn out from battling a terrible, debilitating disease? Someone who has decided the time has come to end her life? Or through the mind of a caring man who's opened his home and his heart to a child in great need, only to have the court order that that child be returned to his mother when she gets out of jail? And how do the lives of these two people intersect? Those questions drive a new novel, 5 Days Left. It's by Michigan author Julie Lawson Timmer, and she's here with us now. And Julie, this isn't just your new novel, this is your first novel.
It is. Thank you very much for having me. It is the first novel, though my mother will tell you that when I was 5, I wrote a book called The Battle of the Bread and Jams with no vowels at all. And so she still claims that is my first novel.
That is great. Mothers would say that,
right,
wouldn't they?
Right.
That is great. And we're going to talk a little later about how a busy working attorney carves out the time to write and turns out something that is getting such strong reviews. In fact, I should note among many reviews, Kirkus Reviews writes, and here's a quote, Timmer's emotional debut about saying goodbye should come with a box of tissues. Start by explaining, Julie, the significance of this title, 5 Days Left.
Sure. With both characters, Mara Nichols, who's a lawyer in Dallas, Texas, and Scott Kaufman, who's a middle school basketball coach in Royal Oak, Michigan, have 5 days left with the ones they love most. And the book tracks both stories over those 5 days. So as the book opens, Mara is considering taking her life in 5 days to spare herself and her family from the end stages of a truly terrible disease, Huntington's. And Scott has 5 days left with a little boy he's been looking after with his wife while the little boy's mother is in jail.
And I have to tell you, number one, I read the book in one day. I really, really liked it. And I thought you did such a skillful job, and it doesn't always happen, of taking us from the present to the past and weaving that all together back and forth. Nice job, because we always know where we're at.
Thank you very much.
I'm going to have you read an excerpt, but tell us first about Mara Nichols.
Sure. Mara Nichols is actually came to me after a friend of mine lost a fairly lengthy battle with cancer, and she knew that she was dying and wouldn't be around for her children, and I became absolutely consumed with the injustice of her situation. And I thought the book might be a way to honor my friend. I actually thought it might be a way for me to work through the feelings of injustice I had about this disease taking someone's life so short. That didn't happen. I'm just as enraged about Huntington's and ALS and cancer as I was when I started. But that's how I originally conceived of Mara, who's a type A, very independent lawyer and mother in Dallas, Texas. She wants to be in control of her life and always has been. And she is furious that a disease like Huntington's is going to control how she lives out her final days. And she's thinking maybe she wants to take her own life into her own hands while she still has the chance.
And then two interesting choices I'd like you to talk about. She is an adoptee and she has an adopted daughter, and she's Indian background, and her little adopted daughter Lakshmi comes from an Indian orphanage. Why did you make those choices?
Well, this is interesting. I just had to confess to some high school students who were asking me questions about the book that actually, when I started writing notes about this book, Mara came to me almost fully formed. And it just so happened she was heading back to India with her parents to adopt a child there, having been adopted from there herself. And one of the questions I got from the high schoolers was, did you give her an adopted daughter so that we wouldn't have to worry about this daughter having this genetic disease? And I said, no, but at one point I realized the daughter was adopted and I thought, well, that's handy because now we don't have to worry about it. But that wasn't anything I consciously planned, which is funny to me.
It just, she came that way.
She came that way.
Would you read the excerpt that kind of opens the book?
Sure. This is from chapter one. Mara had chosen the method long ago. Pills, vodka, and carbon monoxide. A garage cocktail, she called it. The name sounded almost elegant, and sometimes when she said it out loud, she could make herself believe it wasn't horrifying. It would still be horrific for Tom, though, and she hated herself for that. She would rather do it without leaving a body for him. But as much as she'd love to spare him from being the one to discover her, she knew not letting him find her would be worse. And at least this was the tidiest option. He could have someone come and take her car away, fill her side of the garage with something else to block the image, bikes maybe, gardening supplies, a second car for himself. Maybe she should arrange to have one delivered after. Would that be too weird, though? A gift from your dead wife. She should have given him one years ago, for their anniversary or to celebrate bringing baby Lakshmi home. Or just because. She should have done so many things. Mara frowned. How could it be that she had spent almost 4 years ticking off all those items on her long list of things to do before she died, yet here she was, 5 days from it, and still thinking of things she should have done? Ah, but that was the trick of it. Tell yourself you'll wait until you've accomplished every last thing and you'd keep putting it off, because there would always be one last thing. Which might be fine for someone who had the luxury of delaying a few more weeks or months or years even until they were finally out of excuses and ready to go through with it. Mara didn't have that luxury. In less than 4 years, Huntington's disease, the mother of all brain cell destroyers, had already done more damage than she and Tom could have ever prepared for. She had the severance papers from the law firm to prove it. The once graceful, athletic body that was now slow to react, reluctant to cooperate. If she allowed herself to experience that one more moment with her husband and daughter, to travel to that one last must-see destination, she might wake the next morning to find it was too late and Huntington's was in control, and she would be trapped in the terrifying in-between of not being able to end her life on her own and not truly living either. Time was against her. She couldn't risk waiting any longer. She could make it to Sunday as she had planned, but she couldn't wait past then.
That's writer Julie Lawson Timmer reading from her first novel that's called 5 Days Left. Tell us now about Scott Kaufman.
Sure. Scott Kaufman, like I said, is a middle school basketball coach, and he lives in Royal Oak, Michigan, which was a thrill for me because I live in Ann Arbor and was happy to write about Michigan. He has a former student who went to the University of Michigan, and we bleed maize and blue in my family, so that was a thrill for my husband and son in particular. He came to me because I wanted to give Mara somebody to speak to who wasn't going through as tragic a situation as she was. There's some humor in Scott's story, and he gives both Mara and the reader, I think, an emotional break. I'm actually part of an anonymous online work-family balance forum and have been for several years. And it's funny because I consider the other people on that forum to be friends, even though we've never met in real life. And I've always been very intrigued by how that could be, that you could be so close to someone you've never met. And so I liked the idea of giving Mara a forum, and that was a way for her to meet this man in Royal Oak, Michigan. I mean, they only meet online, never in person.
And you really, I think, can open conversations through this book. as people read and really get into the minds of someone who may have to give up a child that he's been caring for and has come to love, or someone who is getting ready to walk away from the life she loves with her husband and daughter, and which is the greater of the evils in her mind. And it really is a very skilled way you take us through what's in their minds. What do you hope listeners, what do you hope readers get out of this book?
Thank you, first of all. I hope that readers realize what I think I have come to realize, and that is that as much as we like to say, if a certain thing happened, here's exactly what I would do, or I would never do this, or I would always do that, it is not so easy when you're actually in that situation. I don't think, personally, there is any right or wrong answer to the many questions raised in this book.
Now, you're an attorney. You work as in-house counsel for a company in Oakland County. Where did that writer side come from, apart from the five-year-old who wrote the Bread and Jam book? Where did that drive come from to say, I'm going to do something completely different from the way I earn my living?
You always hear that so many lawyers write. And at one point, I realized that if I got to the end of my days, the one regret I would have is that I didn't try to write a novel and get it published. And if I tried and failed, that would be fine with me. But I didn't want to get to an advanced age and think, wow, I never tried. And so one benefit, I think, of being a lawyer is that we have deadlines with the court on a certain day, and it doesn't matter if you feel like writing. You get the 50-page brief finished, and you file it on time, or you've committed malpractice, and you've probably lost your job. And so for me, I wrote this book between 4 in the morning and 6 in the morning every day before I went to work, and almost 20 years now of being a lawyer, I've just learned, you know, when it's time to write, you just write.
It served you well. Did you take a writing class? Did you just kind of rely on your gut instincts?
I didn't take a writing class. After I had finished a draft of the novel, I went to a writing conference and learned a great deal from not only the instructors, but some of the people that I was in the conference with who have remained good friends and have been very supportive of this book.
How many drafts?
Oh, man. It's way more than I can even count. And the first drafts have no resemblance to the book in front of you today. I mean,
wow.
Yeah.
So the process, it almost pulled you down the path.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Was it scary to put it out there and offer it up and try to find an agent and try to sell this?
Oh, my gosh. Much scarier than I ever would have realized to send out your own writing. And again, because I'm a lawyer, I'm used to getting something back with red scribbles all over it, and I don't have sort of that pride of authorship. I don't take that personally. But when it's your own thoughts, and so many, when you're writing a novel, so many of a character's thoughts can be related to thoughts you've had yourself. Mm-hmm. It's amazing when somebody says, oh, I started your book, and then they don't say whether they finished it or whether they liked it. I mean, it's can be agonizing.
So there's a personal thing in this book, In 5 Days Left, that perhaps is not, that's the heart where the intellect might be writing that lawyer's brief.
That's exactly right. That's the difference.
That's fascinating. Yep. And you've gotten some great words of praise that are printed on the cover of the book from some very big authors, including Jodi Picoult. When you got these kudos from these authors, what were your thoughts?
What an honor. And honestly, I'm not sure I still believe that. I have a friend who sends me an email almost once a week, and all it says in all caps is Jodi Picoult with an exclamation mark. And I'll write back and say, I know.
So what's ahead? Another novel?
Yes, I've finished another novel, and I'm hoping that that'll be on the shelves someday in the near future. And I'm starting the third.
And you're still working as an attorney.
And I'm still working and still wrangling a bunch of teenagers at the house.
So you're juggling many plates in the air skillfully at one time. Julie Lawson-Timmer of Oakland County, where she works, in Washtenaw County, Ann Arbor area, where she lives. And the novel is called 5 Days Left. I really, really enjoyed this read. So thanks for a great, great story. And I look forward to your next book.
Thank you very much for having me.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. As college students explore their campuses this autumn, they're likely to find a wide array of student groups that involve race and ethnicity. The Black Student Union, Asian American groups, Hispanic and Latino groups. Universities, including top-tier schools, say they are spending money on trying to increase the number of minority students, especially since the 2006 Supreme Court ban on affirmative action. But is there too much focus on racial diversity and not enough on economic diversity?
Ron Haskins is a senior fellow in economic studies at the Brookings Institution, and he co-directs the Center on Children and Families. Welcome, Ron.
Good to be here.
So what do you think, Ron? Should the challenge for America's colleges be less about addressing the racial diversity problem and more about addressing problems with economic diversity?
Yes. And keep in mind that if you address problems with income differences, you are addressing racial differences because, on average, blacks in the U.S. have less income than whites. So the group that you'd be focused on would be disproportionately black. And it's less controversial. It's probably legal. It's an American tradition that we focus on low-income families and try to give them, you know, more benefits. And we should be even more committed to doing it in education, because if people get a good education, they can escape poverty and they would be upwardly mobile. So if we could successfully prepare low-income kids for college and help them get through college, including two-year colleges, it would make a huge impact on inequality and on economic mobility in the United States.
So looking at the Black Student Union or the Asian American Students Group, that's all well and good, but there really is a need to go deeper.
I applaud and strongly encourage community groups that try to help low-income students from their ethnic group or country background or whatever it is. That's a great thing. That's private, and they ought to do it. And Godspeed if they could be successful, because Lord knows public policy is not being very successful. But if we're talking about public policy, then we should focus on low-income students of whatever race, color, ethnic group, and so forth, and do everything we can think of to help them prepare for college. There are many differences between low-income families and middle-class families that bear on the chances that a low-income kid will go to college.
Mm-hmm.
But the most important thing is academic preparation in high school. If you look at the bottom 20%, in other words, maybe $25,000 or so in income, only 34% of them enroll in school, and only 11% graduate. So they're two-thirds drop out of school before they graduate. By contrast, in the top quintile, 79% enroll in school and 53% graduate, and that perpetuates the economic conditions that was present in the parents' generation. So this is a nut we have to crack if we're serious about equal opportunity in the United States.
And yet we hear from school districts and school administrators that have had to cut and had to retrench, and so there's a lot of work to be done there.
Yes. I would point out that we spend more on our education system than any other nation in the world. It's kind of like our health system, and we don't get very good results. And we get very good results with kids from middle-class families. But where we really fall down is kids from low-income and minority families. One reason is they go to lousy schools. You look at inner cities, and minorities disproportionately live in inner cities, and they go to some of the worst schools in the country. So it's not a great surprise that they're not well prepared for college. And that's especially the case because, and here this is very controversial, so I want to say it as carefully as I can.
Mm-hmm.
Their parents do not have college experience. Their parents usually do not have a high education beyond high school, many of themselves high school dropouts. And there are many studies that show that for the kind of home environment that's necessary to prepare kids for college, so an emphasis on academics, making sure the household is quiet, checking the kids' homework, all the kind of things that many middle-class parents do to try to boost the achievement and the performance of their children, many low-income kids do not get. So if you have problems in the home that are not conducive to academic preparation for college, and you have lower college admission rate, and you have lousy high schools and junior high schools, what outcome would you predict?
I'm speaking with Ron Haskins, who is with the Brookings Institution. He co-directs the Center on Children and Families and the Budgeting for National Priorities Project. Ron, let's look at the universities and the colleges of America. We have heard, especially elite colleges, promising to admit low-income students, but most top-tier colleges haven't really upped their percentage of poor students in a generation. Why do you think that is?
If they maintain admission standards that will be the inevitable result. So if the universities are going to do something about it, I think they're going to have more coordination with the public schools. They're going to have to encourage the public schools to do a better job. And they're going to have to encourage more kids to be in, hopefully, more successful programs that are apart from the public schools but often operate in the public schools, that try to give kids experiences during either junior high or senior high or both that help prepare them for college. So mentoring, counseling, help of finding a good college, help with financial preparation and all that. If the universities continue to get kids who are not prepared for college, they're just going to fail out as they do now. And here's another thing that's really important. A lot of these kids borrow money to go to college because another disadvantage they have is their parents don't have much money. So they borrow money to go to college. They fail or they drop out of college. Now they don't get the benefit, and yet they're stuck with a debt. Universities have billions and billions of dollars, especially the elite schools, in scholarship money. There's no controversy about a highly qualified kid from a low-income family. But what about a kid with modest qualifications that, in any fair competition, would not normally be admitted to the university? So can the university change its standards a little bit to admit low-income people? I think that that is more constitutionally permissible than considering race in admission. That's certainly what the Supreme Court has said.
We spend time kind of looking at figures that talk about the elite, the Georgetowns, the Michigans, the Vassars. It sounds like what you're saying is we need to consider getting them into college, period, right? As opposed to whether they get into an elite college, whether, as you say, it's a two-year program,
right.
Get them in.
Yeah, we should be cautious about this. If the kid is admitted to a school that's above his capability, he or she is going to have a rough time. But similarly, if there are kids that are from low-income families in inner-city schools and so forth who are highly qualified and they go to a lousy school, they're likely to drop out of a lousy school. They need to be challenged. They need to be in a university that's matched to their abilities. And so here's another thing that we could do. If we had good counselors in the high schools preparing the kids for college in the sense of knowing how to look for the right college, trying to find a match between the kids' test scores and their performance on a report card in school and how selective the college is, those are very, very important things that universities, this is another example of something universities could do to help to encourage the public schools to provide that kind of service. And we do know that schools that disproportionately serve low-income kids are less likely to have counselors, and the counselors they have are probably less qualified as well.
There's a lot of what-ifs in all of this, isn't there?
Oh, yes, a lot. Almost everything I've said has been somewhat discouraging, I guess.
I know. Where's the light?
Yeah. Well, I think there is light. I think we're doing better. First of all, I think that many universities are really committed to this issue. They want to do something. They're trying to do things. For example, one study at community college in New York, and the kids took their courses together, three courses, including a course that tried to prepare them for college work, and they stayed together for 2 years. Oh, and the teachers, the professors tried to communicate with each other. They tried to build a kind of esprit de corps among these classes of kids who took their coursework together. And it had impacts on how many courses they completed. It had impacts on how well they did in their courses.
It almost sounds like the idea of maybe having a grade 13 and 14 when you talk about that esprit de corps and kind of making them feel maybe more in their comfort zone.
Yes, I think part of this is undoubtedly psychological as opposed to, you know, just straight academic preparation. The kids can help each other. The kids can tutor each other. They can, if one of their values is to do well in school and stay in school and get their degree, that's the kind of mechanism that could have an impact. But in any case, it did have impact. And if we can build from that, there is some hope. By contrast, one of the initial strategies for kids that came to college unprepared, who are disproportionately low income and minority, was to give them remedial courses in English and in math, especially English. And they did not work. They pretty much have been a failure around the country. Again,
why is that?
Because once a kid gets to be 18 and they haven't done well in school and they don't have the basics, it takes a lot to teach that to them. It's more than just one course of, you know, an hour a day or 3 hours a week or whatever it is. It takes a tremendous commitment to try to learn the basics that then has an impact on their performance in all their other courses. I'm increasingly inclined over the, say, 5 years that I've been looking into this to believe that if the kids are not prepared by the time they graduate from high school, it's a rough course ahead.
Ron Haskins is a senior fellow in economic studies at the Brookings Institution. Ron, it has been a pleasure to talk with you, and I hope we do it again soon.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it.
One school that is recruiting and graduating low-income students is Kalamazoo College. The New York Times ranks Kalamazoo College number 12 in the nation among elite colleges that enroll a large percentage of Pell Grant-eligible students. Kalamazoo College President Eileen Wilson-Oyelaren joins us now. Very good to have you on Stateside.
Thank you so very much.
We have just heard Ron Haskins of Brookings talking about why elite schools need to try harder and get more creative to attract and keep low-income students. And you're doing it at Kay College. When did this become a priority?
Well, this became a priority for us around 2006. But I should say that it's really consistent with our institutional mission. We were founded in 1833. To be a higher educational institution for folks on the prairie in the emerging frontier. So in many ways, I would say we've gone back to our roots and our history, making sure that we include among our student body students from a variety of ethnic and economic backgrounds.
And what led to this ramping up that you know, kind of returning to the roots, as you put it, in 2006?
Well, we had a serious conversation as part of our strategic planning process, and a critical component of that was diversity of all types, including economic diversity. We feel it's important for our classroom conversations and our residence hall discussions to be informed by a diversity of perspectives and experiences. At the time, we were only about 9% Pell-eligible students.
And what are you at now?
We are now about 21%.
And there's really a twofold challenge, isn't there? There's recruiting low-income students and then retaining them, helping them be successful and getting them to graduation. Let's look first at recruiting. How did you get creative in recruiting these kids?
We began to do a variety of new things. We reached out to new partners, particularly community-based organizations. We reached out to alumni who might have connections that could assist us in our recruiting process. And we also felt it was very important for students who did not have a tradition of college going to be able to imagine themselves on our campuses. So particularly students from the Chicago area and students from Detroit and every once in a while even students from California, we brought to the campus for them to have an opportunity to experience the campus for a period of time, to get into classes, to envision themselves in this space.
Now, we did hear as we talked with Ron Haskins of Brookings that it can be a greater challenge for colleges like yours because a lot of times these students don't have the best high school preparation. How do you address that disparity?
So we begin the very first day they arrive. We have a brunch that includes both the students and their parents, and it accomplishes several things. It enables the students to recognize that there are many of them on campus who are first generation. They hear from upper level students who are first generation who've been very successful. We have first generation faculty members at that event. So it's really a way of saying you can do this and you belong here. And then we encourage the students to think about what kind of supports might be helpful for them during the course of the year. And we may have workshops having to do with study skills. We may have workshops dealing with time management. The college already has programs for academic support. The challenge often is getting students to recognize that seeking that support is a smart thing to do. Good students access support rather than students who are weak. A good student accesses support. And we really try to give those messages in a variety of places.
Where do you draw the line between supporting and propping up and spoon feeding?
We like to describe Kalamazoo College as high challenge, high support. And so we don't spoon feed because we have very high expectations for the academic performance of our students as well as their engagement in the community and on campus. And those expectations do not waver. However, we are willing to provide support, advice, guidance, mentorship as students work to meet those expectations.
You're coming up on about 10 years now since this renewed push to bring in low-income students. How has this made a difference at Kalamazoo College?
I think that it has expanded the horizons of those students. I feel very strongly that when you bring a student from humble economic backgrounds and that student is able to graduate, you can change the trajectory of that student's family, and that student's community. I also think that our students who come from more privileged backgrounds learn a great deal from interacting with these students and perhaps are able to question some of their own assumptions about how the world is and how the world works.
And what's ahead? Are you hoping to expand your fundraising to maybe make more scholarships available?
We're actually in a campaign right now. A critical component is endowed scholarships, and we've received wonderful support from alumni and friends. I think it's important to recognize that although we assess these students by saying they're Pell eligible, for every Pell dollar we get from the federal government, the college is matching that five or sixfold.
And what kind of response, not just in terms of dollars donated, but what kind of response are you getting from donors and alums?
It was very interesting. The New York Times article has gotten the most like hits on our Facebook page of anything that we've had, and it's over 20,000 hits since last Wednesday, I believe.
Well, so clearly people are liking what they're seeing, and your hope is let's do more.
Exactly.
Eileen Wilson Oyelaren is the president of Kalamazoo College. Kalamazoo College, named in a New York Times story, is among the best in the nation at enrolling and graduating low-income students. It was good to talk with you, President. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our director today was Allie Billings, and our engineer was Bob Scon. Contributors are Mike Blank, Michelle Hahn, Haley Hirschman, and Annie Norris. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.